Bob Costas and Tony Kubek back at Wrigley Field in Chicago.
Changed my whole career in one game. Took my expectations as a player to a whole nother level.
Sooner is coming in to try and protect the one-run lead. Tito Landrum playing Sandberg very deep in left field.
Saturday game of the week. Everybody watching.
Into left center field and deep. This is a tie ball game. Whitey Herzog has watched leads of 7-1 and 9-3 evaporate.
Sandberg with a 4-for-5 day. The 1-2 hitters have been outstanding for the Cubs today.
This has just been a great ball game. The Cardinals come up with two, and Willie McGee was the key man of the inning. They take an 11-9 lead to the bottom of the 10th. Is it safe today? Don't bet on it. Coming up after the baseball, Eusebio Pedroza versus Gerald Hayes from Panama. I hope it's half as exciting as this ball game has been, unless something should change drastically here in the last of the 10th. This week's NBC Light Beer from Miller player of the game is Willie McGee.
Here comes the man again. What a day he's had.
There may be a new player of the game.
Fine
Sandberg,
six.
Five hits, including two home runs. We will go to the 11th, tied at 11. Sandberg, in the Cubs' last at-bat, has twice delivered a game-tying home run, a solo shot of the night. A two-run blast with two out of the 10th. Tony, not only can I not remember the last time I broadcast a game this good, I can't remember the last time I've seen a game this enjoyable, this entertaining.
Well, you get those kinds here in Fenway Park, don't you, or Detroit's Tiger Stadium?
I don't think I'd be a Hall of Famer or have a statue if it wasn't for the catapult of that one game.
Dave Owen delivers the game-winning hit. Ryan Sandberg and Willie McGee will share our light beer from Miller player of the game. Can't remember the last time I saw a better one.
By the way, you're welcome, Bob, for those highlights the Cub fans watch every year, and they've heard so many times.
And in fact, MLB Network is going to run the Sandberg game in its entirety this weekend. So for people who didn't get a chance to enjoy it or want to enjoy it again, it will be available for them. Bob Costas is Bob Costas.
He really is.
And he joins us now on the Circa Resort and Casino Hotline. We don't have time to even go through Bob's resume.
I don't know what we need to.
Please don't.
No, we're not going to. We're just really thankful that you had the time and the inclination to join us here in Chicago on the Speed Going Home show to talk about Rhino. I find, Bob, as I get older, that I have to lend a lot of context to younger people things that have happened, and it's interesting, and I enjoy when younger people ask me about stuff. How would you describe to people who weren't living and weren't baseball fans during that time what that game meant to baseball, to you and your career, and to Ryan Sandberg?
Well, that would be a remarkable game if it happened tomorrow. Just remarkable for the sheer facts of the game. But it's the context that elevates it and makes it still resonate more than 40 years later, to the point where I think there have been three separate documentaries about it. And it's the signature game of a Hall of Fame career. It also marked the Cubs in 1984 as no longer the woebegone, lovable losers, inhabitants of Wrigley Field, but a real contender. And in fact, they came within a game of going to the World Series. But the context is that it's the mid-1980s, and the media landscape has not exploded. Relatively few games were on TV. Chicago was an exception, because almost every game was on WGN, and the superstation had just taken hold, not just out of Chicago, but in Atlanta, WTBS, so there were Braves fans all around the country and Cubs fans all around the country. But for most fans, the majority of their home team's games were on radio only. And if you lived in a non-big league city, I keep using Montana as an example, you know, pick wherever you want. If you lived in Montana, the only game you saw all week long was that Saturday afternoon game of the week, which sometimes, the Sandberg game included, got ratings higher than hit primetime shows get today, or that some postseason baseball games get today. This was your one chance to see Fernando Valenzuela face Johnny Bench. Or if you lived in a National League town, your one chance to see Carl Yastrzemski or Al Kaline or Mickey Mantle, or the reverse, If you lived in an American League town, maybe your one chance outside of the All-Star game to see Willie Mays or Roberto Clemente or Hank Aaron. I'm going back to the 60s and 70s there. But the same thing applies because the game of the week was an institution on NBC with Kurt Gowdy, with Joe Garagiola, with Tony Kubek, with the great Vin Scully. And then I was thrown in kind of as an afterthought. And I just was lucky enough early in my career to be doing the backup game. And the backup game became the lead game that day, June 23rd, 1984. And Sandberg had the game of a lifetime. Now, have I seen a few games since then, including in the postseason? And it's elevated if it's in the World Series or a big postseason game. Have I seen a handful of regular season games that just on the facts of the game rank with that? Yeah. I mean, Nick Kurtz from the A's, I've got his name right, Nick Kurtz, the big Amish from Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Yes,
okay.
Sir.
He went 6 for 6 with 4 home runs and a double, and the double almost cleared the fence. Now, objectively, now he was playing in Houston, not at home. It's not Wrigley Field. Objectively, that's a better game. But will it resonate the same? No, because Nick Kurtz is yet to prove that he'll be a Hall of Fame player. Plenty impressive, but it was, as I said, the signature game of a Hall of Fame career. It was the big game in an epic season as the Cubs come out of nowhere and very nearly get to the World Series. And it was at Wrigley Field in the game of the week, when the game of the week meant something drastically different than any regular season game means today.
If you're listening, you know that's Bob Costas here on the Spiegel and Holmes Show on 670 The Score. It's kind of, I wonder if people can wrap their heads around the woe begone Cubs, as I believe you called them. They hadn't been to the postseason since 1945 at that point.
Yeah.
Hadn't won anything. They didn't have an MVP since Ernie Banks went back to back in 58 and 59 at that point. So, you know, nationally, for you guys in conversation, I wonder if the Cubs were sort of a sleeping giant in that here's a big market. Maybe this is useful for us on the national level if they're any good. And then, oh, my God, look at that. They're actually kind of good. I wonder if it had any of that to it.
I was never in any of those conversations with executives and producers. I went where they sent me and I prepared and I was delighted to be part of the NBC Game of the Week. But you liked it even more when it was at Fenway or when it was at Wrigley because of the atmosphere involved. And remember, the Cubs got to the postseason that year by winning the division. There was no wild card. There were then 24 teams, 4 divisions of 6 teams each, and only 4 teams, the division winners, went to the postseason. So the Cubs went directly to the league championship series, which then was best of 5 rather than best of 7 against the Padres, won the first 2 games convincingly at Wrigley Field. Now the whole nation has Cubs fever, and nothing against the Padres. Steve Garvey had a heroic game 4, hit a game-winning homer off Lee Smith. But I think most of the nation outside San Diego was crestfallen that the Padres won the next 3 games in San Diego, and they went to the World Series against the Tigers. I was savoring the possibility, again, nothing against the Padres, I was savoring the possibility of a World Series, and the World Series was on NBC that year, and I was the pregame and postgame host, and Vin Scully and Joe Garagiola called it. But I was thinking, how epic would a World Series be at Tiger Stadium and Wrigley Field? And those hopes were dashed.
Bob, all of us that go into this are in some ways storytellers, and we love telling the stories of the games that we cover. And usually we don't really want to be a part of that story. We just kind of want to tell the story.
Yeah.
What's it mean to you that when Rhino talks about, when he talked about that game, that you are part of his story, his Hall of Fame story, and he's been very adamant about that.
Yeah. I think part of it may have been the way Tony and I covered it, but the biggest part was that it was just on the NBC Game of the Week, not to belabor the point. The players used to call it the game of the world. If they saw Vin and Joe or me and Tony at the batting cage on Friday, we must be the game of the world tomorrow, meaning that much of the baseball world, including many of their peers because there were night games and people would be watching the Saturday afternoon game. Ball players would be watching it. So it meant something to the players to be on that game. Now almost every game is on TV somewhere. It's meaningful, but not as meaningful. So I think that accounts for a lot of how Ryan feels. But it was very, very flattering and meaningful to me that every time we crossed paths, he would express his appreciation for the small part in my mind that I played in the signature game of his career, which is why he asked me to introduce him on June 23rd, 2024, the 40th anniversary of the Sandberg game, which was when the Cubs appropriately unveiled his statue outside Wrigley Field.
What was that day like for you, Bob? It was a beautiful ceremony.
It was a beautiful ceremony. True to Ryan Sandberg, two of the people he asked to speak were Larry Boa and Sean Dunstan, his primary double play partners at shortstop over the years with the Cubs. And I heard Sean Dunstan talking with Mark DeRosa and Robert Flores and Lauren Shahadi today on the Major League Baseball Network. And Sean Dunstan broke down. He actually told them beforehand, I only want to do this on the phone. I don't want to be on camera. I don't want to do a Zoom because I think I'll be too emotional. And that was an accurate self-assessment. He talked about Ryan getting on the phone sometime very recently, knowing that his days were numbered, and talking to Sean Dunstan and Andre Dawson and telling them that he loved them, and they answering in kind, we love you too.
We have seen that video from MLB Network and played that earlier on the Score.
Yeah, realized.
It was beautiful. Last hour, Bob, we had Andre Dawson on this show, had a chance to talk to Andre, and he struggled to get through the first few moments of the interview. And spoke about, you know, talking to Ryan, who was positive and strong. And then Ryan's daughter hopped on the phone and said, look, he's got maybe a week, just so you know.
Yeah.
But that wasn't him. But it's interesting because we also played some tape from Doug Glanville, who said that Ryan's quiet demeanor showed him a path of how he could be. And there's three. Mm-hmm. There's three right there. Andre Dawson, Ryan Sandberg, Doug Glanville. There have obviously been many others since. But that's one way of being dignified and quiet if it's true to yourself and being a great ball player. Ryan Sandberg is an example of that possible way to live it. Isn't he sort of DiMaggio-esque, perhaps, as I think about it?
No question. Although Joe DiMaggio, who I was lucky enough to know and I had a good relationship with him, you know, there were some peaks and valleys in Joe's life and maybe some a brooding aspect to his character. I say that with respect. And we all, Ryan included, you know, have moments in our lives that aren't perfect or aren't happy. But I think that Ryan's path was straighter than that of most, that most of his life typified who he was as a player and as a person. He was an elegant player. He was a nearly flawless player. Was he as spectacularly great as the greatest players in the Hall of Fame? No, he didn't hit 500 home runs. He didn't break any records other than, I guess, maybe some records at the time for consecutive errorless games at second base. He didn't get to the Hall of Fame by being every year the best player in the league. He got there by being one of the best players in the league for a very long time, for being consistently excellent in every aspect of the game. To me, it's an amazing stat or an interesting stat that the year he was MVP, 1984, he hit 19 home runs, two of them that day at Wrigley Field. But he also led the league with 19 triples, and he hit a lot of doubles, and he stole bases, and he played a nearly flawless second base. He won gold gloves by playing errorless ball, more so than by making highlight reel plays, although he made some of them. And the way he carried himself, even then, was distinctive. And when you contrast it, I don't want to sound like get off my lawn, but when you contrast it to the way some people now will celebrate a bloop single, this guy, during the Sandberg game, was one of the epic games of all time. He put his head down and ran around the bases. Was he exhilarated? Yeah, you could see the smile on his face when he greeted his teammates in the dugout, or they greeted him. But he was true to himself always. And in his Hall of Fame speech, the key word was respect. That was the theme. Respect the game. Respect your craft. And I think he embodied that almost every day of his baseball life. And when you mentioned, Matt, the ceremony when they unveiled the statue, Craig Counsell led all of the players in uniform out onto the balcony overlooking Gallagher. Now, the speaker's podium had you facing out toward the crowd gathered on the lawn, so that was behind you. But my wife, Jill, was in the front row, and she made eye contact with me and pointed, like, look up there. So I turned around and looked up there, and to me, that moment, with the players not saying anything, just quietly gathered out there to watch, exemplified two things. The generational connections that baseball exemplifies more than any other sport. The history, the nostalgia, it's just bigger in baseball than in other sports. But even more important in that moment is the idea of respect. Ryne Sandberg respected the game. He respected his teammates and his opponents. And as a result, that respect was reciprocated throughout his life and throughout his career, and especially in that moment.
Bob, we had Craig Counsell on this show earlier in the day, too. I don't mean to name drop. It's been a packed show. But anyway, Craig said he called that his favorite day as a Cub. That day.
There you go.
Exactly what you're talking about.
Craig grew up around the game. He has great respect for the game. Played second base some during his career as well. You know, he would get it. You wouldn't have to explain it to him.
Bob, I've been thinking a lot over the last like 20 hours or so about the connection that we all have with baseball. But historically, when something like this happens, like, and I know that I'm being a prisoner of the moment. I'm a citizen of the city of Chicago, and Chicago is mourning right now with the loss of Rhino. But I keep thinking about the history of the Cubs. And therefore the history of the National League, and therefore the history of baseball writ large, and how even in a moment where sports is so fragmented and baseball is trying to find a justification for itself in many ways, that there's something about this that does feel big. I'm glad that it's big, that nationally people are like, this is tragic to lose Rhino. And I love that there is this kind of connection to history that is being shared and enjoyed in a way that we don't do enough when it comes to baseball at this point in the timeline.
Yeah, the Cubs are, always have been and remain, one of the flagship franchises in baseball because of the team's history, because of Wrigley Field. You know, it makes a difference. You can say that this team has such and such a history, but many of them have been in two or three ballparks. All the history of the Red Sox resides at Fenway, and almost all the history of the Cubs resides at Wrigley Field. So it just resonates more. The entire nation was captivated by the Cubs in 2016. And that Game 7 against Cleveland, which now is the team that has waited the longest since 1948, without winning a world championship. And had they not been facing the Cubs, they would have been the sentimental favorites. But that Game 7 is the highest rated game up until now. There hasn't been a game since postseason, or obviously regular season, that approached that rating. Any Game 7 in a World Series is going to get eyeballs. But it was the story of the Cubs, really, that captivated the nation.
Bob, you're the best. Thank you for answering the call. I love this idea of you and Sandberg inextricably linked forever, and your career since is it's gone pretty well. I gotta say, we'll go over the resume next time if you'll allow.
Spare the audience and spare me, but I appreciate the thought, Matt.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks, Lawrence.